Pitcairn Island, of course, that's another story. But what is interesting is that 1791, Bligh was back in Tahiti again, following through his breakthrough project. He also charted a number of areas on the Pacific littoral. He charted areas of Van Diemen's Land, as namely. He charted Fiji, he charted the Torres Strait, the top end of Australia, beyond Queensland, helping to make the Pacific coast, Pacific littoral, of the Australian continent, as it was, better charted, safer for seamen. The other thing that people don't know about Captain Bligh is that he suffered the indignity of a second mutiny. You might say that one mutiny is kind of sort of unlucky, but two is, well, going a bit far. In 1806, because of his knowledge of the Pacific area, he had been made governor of New South Wales, an Australian colony in the southeast of that continent. It was a penal colony, as I'm sure most of you are aware. Convicts were sent halfway around the world from Britain and put to work in that part of Australia. So it's a kind of tough sort of place, as you can imagine. It had been ruled, and I think ruled is the right way, by the so-called Rum Corps. This was a local militia, a local redcoats, who kind of set up something of a sort of trading racket. They had cornered economic activity in New South Wales. And a succession of governors had come along and tried to break the power of the Rum Corps without any success, and any real success. And Bligh came along and said, I'm going to crack these guys, I'm going to break their monopoly of economic activity. And he might have done, but the Rum Corps, the local militia, were having none of it, hence the second mutiny, when in what was essentially a coup d'etat, in which he was deposed as governor and put into a kind of exile down in Van Diemen's Land. Interestingly, the British government kind of hushed it all up. Having messed up over the American colonies, they didn't want to mess up over the Australian colonies, so they pretended that none of this had happened. And in the end, Captain Bligh returned to Britain, where, well, the British had a curious way of elevating their failures, he was promoted out. Yeah. so forth. But as I hinted already, and as we all know, it's mining that gives real content to the story of the Cornish overseas, and not least in the Midlands region. We tend to think of this, well, here we are in Rough Valley, we think of North America, of this western seaboard of the USA, but the eastern littoral of the Pacific. The first real contact of Cornish with mining with this littoral was not up here, but further south in Latin America. And Latin America has a pivotal role to play in the story of the Cornish Open Sea, but particularly in the story of the Cornish in the Pacific region. After 1815, that date that I mentioned already, the end of the Napoleonic Wars, really quite a significant date in world history, as a kind of new world order began to emerge in 1815. And the various Latin American countries, they looked at the way the United States had thrown off European rule and thought after 1815, we can do that too. And there was a succession of throwing off Spanish and also Portuguese rule in the years ahead. And that opened the door for British investment. It created a kind of power vacuum, political and economic, which the British filled. And the British became heavily involved in the development of mining in Latin America in the years after 1815. Lots of British capital, and though what followed British capital were Cornish miners and Cornish mining technology. That expansion went hand in hand. Richard Trevithick, who is one of the great heroes of Cornish history, as I'm sure you know, first experiment successfully of high pressure steam in the application of high pressure steam, deep mining, inventor of the railway locomotive, and so on and so forth. He was one of the first Cornish to recognize the potential of Latin America. And very early on, even before the end of the Napoleonic Wars, he had been invited to design and build beam engines, pumping engines, winding engines. To help redevelop the silver mines of Peru. They were duly sent out from Cornwall, but when they arrived, they didn't really work. The altitude was very high, the people who were erecting them didn't really have that kind of hands-on experience that the Cornish engineers, who were very hands-on kind of guys back home, had. And Trevithick thought, well, there's nothing for it, I'm going to have to go out and tweak these engines and show them how to get the best out of them, to show them how to work. And Richard Trevithick did that, traveling across. In the end, he spent a whole of 11 years in Latin America, not just in Peru, but traveling throughout the throughout Latin America, South America up to Central America and so on. Involved in all kinds of adventures, but again, I haven't got time to really tell you much about tonight, but he was nearly eaten by an alligator at one stage, we're told. He got involved in the wars with the Spanish at one stage, various kind of strange. And so on and so forth. And eventually he came back to Cornwall in October of 1827. He died almost penniless in the London suburb of Dartford. We still remember him, of course, as a kind of a Cornish hero. One of the things that perhaps we do forget, though, in remembering Richard Trevithick, it was him who said to people in Cornwall, here in Latin America is a whole new field of opportunity. Needs to be and indeed, as a result of Trevithick's experiences, Cornwall was alerted to the possibility of Latin America. Mexico, it turns out, has a kind of strategic role in this story too. By the 1820s, the Cornish were taking an interest in the revitalization of silver mines in Mexico, Pachuca and Rail del Norte. I've not been to Mexico, but people who have told me the echoes of the Cornish are still there, loud and clear. There are engine houses such as you would find in Cornwall. There are even pastures, although it looks like they're on the side of the tree. Although the various Cornish cultures, that's fine. So it's on my list of places for me to go to at some stage. And what we do know is that Mexico was kind of strategic in this Pacific Rim, because Mexico looks north and south. People in Mexico could go down to Latin America, down to South America. They could also, as we shall find out in a moment, head northwards. They could also come up quite easily into this part of the world as well. And in the 1820s, the 1830s, the large numbers of Cornish were being enticed to Mexico as miners. In functioning pretty well. What was drawing the Cornish to Mexico and to other parts of Latin America was not problems of home as such, much more the enticement of high wages that they could get for their skill, because the people developing the mining systems of Mexico knew that the greatest repository of those mining skills at that time was indeed in war. 1825, there were meetings throughout Cornwall, Truro, Madrid, even across the border in Tavistock in Devon, where a lot of Cornish miners and workers were working with local mines. Strategic meetings throughout Cornwall to try to recruit the best mine captains, the best people who were working with water wheels, the best people who were pitmen and saltmen and carpenters, and all the other ancillary trades that they needed to support the miners themselves. And they all went off with engines as well in kit form, into ships sailing across to Mexico, giving real content to this, this sense of the Cornish taking their skills and their cultures to new destinations overseas. At the same time that that was going on, there was a parallel immigration from Cornwall to Chile. And in exactly the same kind of way, there were meetings up and down Cornwall to try to persuade Cornish miners and all those other ancillary trades to go to Chile as well. Promising high rates of return, remuneration, money, and so on and so forth. And throughout the 1820s and the 1830s, large numbers of the Cornish are going out to Chile to develop, this time, not the silver of Mexico, but copper. This is a very significant development for the international economy as a whole. Here was copper being found in huge, really internationally significant amounts for the first time outside of Cornwall. It shifted the nature of the international copper industry, which sort of Cornish is kind of ironic, because it was the first nail in the coffin of the Cornish copper industry, but they, the Cornish, were playing a central role in actually developing the copper shipping. Large numbers throughout the 19th century, even as late as 1893, the West Briton, which was the main newspaper in Cornwall in those days, it still exists, but it just served really specific part of Cornwall now. In those days, it served the whole of Cornwall. In 1893, someone who had been out to Chile wrote back with a sense of astonishment. Said, "It seems to me that a mine in Chile, without a Cornishman employed in some capacity, is similar to a man going to church without his hat on." So significant, or so the point of becoming involved in the Chilean mining industry in such an intimate Chile, as you know, has a really long Pacific seaboard, an enormously long country, an enormously long littoral looking out into the Pacific. And therefore, it was one of those places from which some kind of trans-Pacific highway linkages could relatively easily develop. And there are various careers that you can trace of Cornish miners who went out to Chile, who find themselves on the edge, therefore, of the Pacific, and who take advantage of that great highway and follow new mines, new countries as they develop. One example that I came across some years ago, a fellow with the wonderful, delightfully Cornish name of Henry Trowdrick. What a name we're hearing more much now, perhaps. Born at Carmarth, not that far from the truth, in 1825. When he was 21 years old, he married Anne Bray, 12 heads, a little village in that neck of the woods, more or less. And they stayed together, they both had long lives, and they went on various adventures. Soon after their marriage, almost immediately after their marriage, they went to Chile along with a whole bunch of other Cornish miners. So they stayed in Chile for 12 years, which is a long time, particularly in those days. But even 12 years in Chile didn't sort of dim their sort of thirst for something new, for new adventure. And like many of the Chilean, Cornish, they decided to move north to California. And there's that kind of Pacific littoral linkage kind of thing working. And they went to California, they worked a year, I guess, on the gold mines. But they didn't stay here forever. They decided to cross the Pacific. They went in the 1840s, 1850s, to the Barabaracoma mine, which I can say a little bit about again in a moment, in South Australia. They worked at the Barra mine. Then there were the rushes of gold, Ballarat and at Clunes in Victoria, in the early 1850s, so they went across there, and then finally they were back into South Australia for yet another mine at Moota, so a bit more like at the moment. And then after Anne died, Henry went up to stay with his daughter, who had moved to the silver mining district of Broken Hill in New South Wales, where eventually he died. And there was a great Pacific story. Chile to California, to South Australia, to Victoria, to back to South Australia, up to finally New South Wales and Broken Hill. But I'm jumping ahead at the moment. I mentioned that the discovery of Chilean copper changed the nature of the world copper industry forever. In the 1840s, there were two other significant discoveries which added more nails to the Cornish coffin and changed the balance of the international coffin once more. One of those was Michigan, across on the other side of America, reminding us, of course, that there was significant Cornish activity outside our Pacific Rim. I don't want to draw a veil over that. In fact, it's important to note just how significant those Michigan coffin discoveries were, not only for America, world, and of course for the eventual fate of the Cornish industry as well. But the other great discovery in the 1840s, just after the Michigan discovery, almost very connected to them, were in South Australia. I mentioned the Burra mine by Henry Crackkeeper, discovered in the mid-1840s, along with Kapunda, just a little way down the road from there, two immensely rich sources of copper, which put South Australia very firmly on the international copper mining map of the world, and in fact gave Australia a position on the international mining frontier that it has never lost. It has always maintained that position as a significant player on the international mining frontier. And a great many Cornish, if you might imagine, flocked to the copper mines of Kapunda and Burra in South Australia. A number of them were already in South Australia. Cornwall had been identified as a place suitable for the kind of immigrants that the South Australian colony wanted, you know, God-fearing, hard-working, Methodist, and all that. But when they got to the Burra mine, not only did they find that this was a hugely successful mine, but also there was the first inkling of a labour movement which would come to characterise the Cornish overseas. Again, I don't really have time to draw out why I think it's an interesting contrast between Cornwall, where the labour movement was really rather slow to develop, and the places where the Cornish went, particularly the west of America, Australia to some extent, South Africa to some extent, where the Cornish became the great leaders of some of the big labour unions. But it is interesting that as early as 1848, there was a strike at the Burra mine in South Australia. It was resolved in a fairly messy kind of way, which we haven't got time to deal with, but one interesting aspect of it was that some of the Cornish miners there were fed up enough to say, well, we've had it with the Burra mine, we're going to go to New Zealand, where copper has just been discovered. If we have any New Zealanders in the audience, I'm sure they'll forgive my awful pronunciation of Maori place name, but there is a place called Tower Island, where copper had been discovered. Is that right? Are New Zealanders ready to... Yes? Is that okay? First meeting, first about 40 miles from Auckland, I think, which I happened to, my cousin lives there. And developed from the mid-1840s, a chap called Captain Innes, another good old Cornish name, had been brought out. And as you go there, I'm told there's a Cornish engine house still there, just like the ones that you will find in Cornwall. And a number of these Burra miners went to augment the workforce out there on Tower Island. Again, this sense of the Pacific as some kind of highway was emerging. And like South Australia, New Zealand had strong Cornish presence in the early days. There was a company, for example, founded in Cornwall to encourage settlement in New Zealand in the 1840s. Lots of Cornish there in the 1860s. In the 1870s especially, the Cornish kind of flooded to New Zealand. Not necessarily not so much as miners, but as part of a strategy kind of enhance to build the rural infrastructure of New Zealand. Associated very much with a man called Julius Ogle, who was the New Zealand colonial treasurer. And like South Australia before him, he identified Cornwall as a source of just the kind of people that would do well in New Zealand, just the kind of people that New Zealand would wish. And I'm told that something like 5,500 people arrived from Cornwall in the 1870s, during the 1870s, which is about 10%, I'm told, of all the immigrants from England and Cornwall during that period. So a large contingent of Cornish people turning up in that part of the Pacific region. Many of them described themselves as agricultural labourer and miner. Partly that because Cornish immigrants were good at hedging their bets. They would tell people they could do all sorts of stuff. So when they actually turned up, they would be seen to be versatile and so on. But many of them actually were. Many of them in Cornwall had been miners and smallholders as well. And that agricultural labouring and mining experience equipped Cornish people for life on the frontiers of a country like New Zealand. Many of those who arrived in the 1870s, imagining themselves to be agricultural settlers, actually turned their hands to the various mining rushes that happened. There's one at Hamilton's at Eastern Takeover, in the 1870s, for example. Lots of gold mines, lots of Cornish, and so on. But again, I'm leaping ahead. The 1870s, I think, to take the story back to the we had left there. That great twin copper discovery is the 1840s, Burrabarra and then across Michigan. After those great copper discoveries, which changed the nature of the international mining economy, were another series of great mineral discoveries, which again sent shockwaves through the international mining economy. This time, of course, it wasn't copper, the Cornishman's metal, if you like, but gold. The gold was found in hard rock, deep quartz. And again, that was a kind of environment in which the Cornish could thrive. Not much gold found in Cornwall, but plenty of hard rock. And the skill of hard rock miners at the Cornish were known at home and also overseas in copper mines, Chile, South Australia, Michigan, could be turned to the hard rock gold country that emerged around the world at the end of the 1840s. The first, and normally like this, the greatest of those, of course, was the Californian gold rush, discovery of gold in 1848, 1849, and then the rush to California. And the Cornish were there from the beginning. We think sometimes that the Cornish coming into their own, as indeed they did, when the mines got very deep and rather technical, when the Cornish expertise came into its own in the 60s, late 60s, and so on. But actually, the Cornish were here from the earliest days. There had already been Cornish miners in California before the rush. There had been a whole bunch of them down New Armadan, the Faroe Country, where they were mining the Cinnabar Hills there for quicksilver and mercury, which, as it turned out, was an important part of the stuff that you need to produce gold. So it was kind of a happy coincidence as well. But there were lots of Cornish down there at New Armadan. There was a place called Cornish Camp. My friend Dave McKinney, who may be lurking in the back, has written a book on the Cornish and their church down at New Armadan, which again, so minded, you can go see today the defense of the Cornish heritage now. There were also, this is back to what I was saying about the strategic nature of Mexico, there were people who came up from Mexico as soon as they had heard of the discovery of gold. Mexico is not that far away, it's on the Pacific. You can come up from Mexico, up that western coast of North America, to this part of the world with relative ease, and indeed they did. There were others who came from back east. There were Cornish miners who came from the Appalachians, shifting, if you like, from the Atlantic USA across to the Pacific USA. There were plenty who came from Wisconsin, Mineral Point, others from Michigan, of course. All those Cornish immigrants who had gone to more easterly or more midwestern parts of the USA, looking across with interest to what was happening over here on the Pacific side of things. And of course, a great many people in Cornwall itself who were taking a great interest in what was going on. By this time, in the middle of the 19th century, Cornwall had got used to being, as what it saw as being, the center of the international mining economy. People were taking close interest in what was happening all across the world, and very informed interest in what was happening as well. Emigrants making really extremely informed decisions about when to go, when not to go, where to go, and where to stay in those places, or to move on, and so on and so forth. Not surprising then that Cornish newspapers, 1849, full of stories of the discovery of gold in California. The West Briton, that newspaper that I mentioned earlier, covering the whole of London, in January 1849, reports, it says, "The gold of California is no foible, minus the lids. The greatest donkey in the United States may, if he will abandon his thistles, touch nothing but gold." And that's the way California was being sold in Cornwall in the middle of the 19th century. Not surprising that lots of people wanted to, as it were, down tools over there and resume them over here. Any number of similar kinds of quotations from the Cornish newspaper. Again, in 1849, again that West Briton newspaper, saying, "If ever there was a call for the skilled labourer of Cornwall, this gold district demands it." See there the subtle expression of that myth of Cousin Jack that I mentioned earlier on. The skilled labourer of Cornwall. There it is, it's assumed, it's asserted. And who demands it? This gold district. And if that wasn't clear enough, a couple of years later, again West Briton, June 1851. "The Cornish are the most accomplished of all miners," it asserts. "The Californians cannot do without Cornishmen." That was the view. When they got here, of course, it was a very bewildering kind of place, very hectic, all kinds of things going on. And as those of you who have looked at the impact of the Cornish in Grass Valley and Valley County will know, in many ways the Cornish brought a kind of moderating influence with chapel rules and various cultural activities and so on, which helped to turn the places from being very raw and riotous mining camps into something a little bit more kind of homely. And some of those who came out here were they had been members of Methodist organisations back in Cornwall, stores, the chapel and so on, were sometimes taken aback with what they found when they arrived on the golf field. As John Roberts wrote to his brother in Cameron, he said, "Sunday is the day for the exhibition of circuses, bullfights, horse races, concerts, fandangos, for drunkenness and all sorts of infectiousness. Scarcely a Sunday passes but some man is killed, and sometimes two or three." Now, that's a problem. What place have we come to? But as I said, the Cornish were amongst those who tried to place some kind of order on this. I came across a published version of a diary of a man called James Hewitt, who came from again the Camborne area, and who came out to this part of the world, from Cornwall, in the middle of the 19th century, and from the Deer Park Indians. Somewhere near when the large city is today. And he gives us an insight into his diary, into some of the rough justice that existed on the goldfield in those early Rush days. And he tells the story of how a thief who had stolen a quantity of gold from a Cornishman called Boyle was captured in a saloon and was brought before an impromptu miners committee called Miners Court. And they very swiftly decide that, yeah, he has committed this particular theft and ought to be punished. And James Hewitt, who was there, witnessed all this, records it in his diary. And he tells us how the man was, first of all, whipped with however many lashes it was, and then he was branded with a letter R. I'm not sure about the letter R, but he was branded so that other people encountering him would know that he was a guy to watch out for. And this is what he said. "So the iron was shaped into the letter R, and the thief tied to a tree and stripped to the bare back. A rough whip was made for the flogging, and he got it severely. His back was a mass of torn flesh. Then the iron was applied to his face, but it was too hot to leave any readable letter. He was loosed with these words, 'If caught again, to be hanged by the neck.'" There, Skewers go to write in the diary. "But I have since heard that he has continued robbing and was finally arrested by the civil authorities and hanged in the same county of Nevada, California." Interesting. Grass Valley, of course, emerges as a central part of the story of the Cornish in California. And again, you don't need me to tell you that story in depth, and I don't have time to do so, but I've quoted from some Cornish newspapers. It's interesting to see what was made of the Cornish on this side of the world. the most part carried on by punishment. Well, that may or may not have been true, but what is interesting is the perception that mining is carried on mostly by punishment. 1871, a decade later, Grass Valley Union says, it's quite interesting, the Cornishman is probably the most skillful foreign miner that comes to our shore. There we are, there's a bit of cousin Jack again, and an assumption of innate superiority. He has acquired this position, although very headstrong, Cornish miners are mostly stalwart, good-looking fellows. Dressed better than any other class of miners, and are very fond of women. They appear more clannish than the other foreigners, and the majority of them are very good singers. When they visit a saloon, they generally arrange themselves around the table, call for a pot of ale or water, and pass the time away in anecdote and song. Now, what a lost change. But, as one historian of this part of the world has risen a few years ago, as well as history, the Cornish, as well as being known as affable, but Spanish, having a nice sing song around the bar, there was also, as he puts it, I think quite nicely, he said, the Cornish had a prickly sense of self. They could be pugnacious when they wanted to be, and they went out of their way to defend that myth of superiority. And there are stories of clashes between the Cornish and other ethnic groups. Typically with the Irish tended to fall out with the Cornish for a whole variety of reasons, around the globe, wherever they rub shoulders. Again, with an opportunity to look into that, the political dimension to it, there's a religious dimension to it, but also there was a mining skills dimension to it, because quite a number of the Irish who turn up at places like Grass Valley and other places around the littoral of the Pacific were themselves skilled hard rock miners, County Cork and elsewhere, not just the labouring stereotype that we have in our conversation, but just the skill of the Cornish, and the Cornish didn't like that, as you can imagine. Again, that sense of the Cornish being rather laid back, rather quiet, anything for a quiet life. It relied by the role that the Cornish played in the development of unions in the American West. There was strikes in the 1817 Grass Valley against the introduction of dynamite rather than powder, against the introduction of single jacking, which is fitting a drill with one hammer rather than two. Again, haven't got time to get into technicalities of that, but seemed to be developments that were undermining the privileged position of the Cornish miner. In the short term, the Cornish got their way. In the long term, they didn't. But the important thing, perhaps, is the way in which the Cornish then went on to dominate the mining labour movements of the West, still fighting with the Irish control of unions in places like Nevada and California and so on, but playing that central role in the labour movement in the West. As well as doing that, the Cornish and Grass Valley do what the Cornish do in other parts of the world. They don't just stick with mining. In fact, many of them, in going overseas to become miners, were actually looking for the means to abandon mining, to better themselves in other ways, to get land, to start businesses. And one of the things that happens in Grass Valley by the 1880s is that the Cornish are turning up doing other things. They are picking up the land. They are moving into other kinds of businesses. The West Prison newspaper again, 1884, some years after the discovery of gold here and after the first settlements in this particular area, West Britain writes in 1884. The Cornishmen here, Grass Valley, are not engaged exclusively in mining. The signs over almost all stores bear Cornish names, and several of the businessmen here hold responsible positions in the county and in the state. So they have also moved into politics, into taking civic responsibility to one sort or another, becoming integral parts of the fabric. The gold rush of California in 1850 had important consequences elsewhere, not least in Australia, where there had been hints and suggestions of gold and gold-bearing rocks and people finding bits of nuggets and so on and so forth. But it was the news of the California rush that galloped that river. by people who were intent on farming. They find copper on their land, so they turn immediately to the industry that they know so well. It also becomes the background to the discovery of the first gold in, what's the official discovery of gold in New South Wales, therefore in Australia. There was a man who came across the Californian goldfields called Edward Allen Hargreaves, who was intent on showing the Australians how to do it, how you find gold in that time of time. And he has gone down in history as a man who made the discovery of gold in New South Wales, California. But as Chris Bunkley reminded us at the conference in Australia about 6 weeks ago, actually, the man who really made the discovery was a man who made loads of techniques from Hargreaves, but it was called William Tom Jr., son of one of the original Cornish settlers at the Cornish settlement. So the Cornish had a major role to play too in the discovery of gold in New South Wales and Australia. Cornish miners come across to the Barrow Mine. They're keeping their ears to the ground about what's happening on the international mining frontier too. They leave the copper mines of South Australia and head across to New South Wales. But just as they're doing that, there's news of even more bigger discoveries, greater discoveries, in the neighbouring colony of Victoria. In July 1851, there's a spectacular rush of Californian standards to the colony of Victoria. Again, the Cornish are there from the start. There were already quite a large number of Cornish in Victoria, farming, doing other things. Victoria had become a focus of Cornish emigration already. There were others who came across from those South Australian copper mines. Again, keeping a very close eye on what was happening in Victoria. Going across, some on the overland route, pretty tricky. Others coming round to the Great Australian Plain. There were Cornish people in Cornwall who heard about West Britain and other newspapers, full of the news of Victoria in just the same way that they were full of the news of California. But there were also a whole bunch of Cornish who made their way from California itself. And we begin to see, again, that Pacific regional dimension asserting itself, movement between California and Victoria and indeed New South Wales as well, which went on for quite some time. Pacific Corridor, people moving between those two areas. For example, Welcome Nugget was one of the first big discoveries of a huge gold nugget in 1858 at Ballarat. I said, there's two Cornishmen. One of their number was a man called William Jeffrey McLuggan, which is between Hamburg and Madrid, or else in Cornwall. He had been out on the Californian gold fields. He knew what he was looking for when he was in Victoria. That would have been the experience of many other Cornish who had gone from California across to Victoria and much at the same time. Melbourne in those days was called typically a second San Francisco. And that's the way it was called. Californians of the day. Towns like Ballarat and Bendigo, still important in history of regional Victoria, kind of grew up as a mirror image of the place of my Grass Valley and Nevada City. But again, there was that sense of bewilderment from some of the point. And I read you that extract from that fellow with Roberts, who wrote back from Spain to his brother in Hamburg about the unholy ways of the Northern people, some of them. Henry Charles over there in Cornwall, in similar vein, says, "This is a terrible place to sit and read. There are thousands here who don't pay any attention to Sunday, no more than any other day. They go shouting and cutting wood and spending the Sabbath in the most fearful way. Butchers do kill on Sunday the same as weekday. There is no respect for persons here. Jack is as good as his master. There is no use for many to come here, and for a man to come here, unless he is steady and not given to drink. There are hundreds here who spend their money as soon as they get here." So that's in California, growth, a big part of rock mining, brought the Cornishes of their own Cornish community to develop, Methodist churches emerged, and so on and so forth. After those discoveries of gold in copper, gold in California and in Australia, the Pacific littoral kind of settles down. So I suggested there's a movement between Victoria and California. There was also movement out. In Australia, there are other discoveries. In 1859, 16, moves from Wallaroo and become the centre of a new copper mining extravaganza, another bonanza. There's Broken Hill in the 1880s, Western Australia in the 1890s, tin is discovered in Tasmania, there's copper and gold in Queensland, so the whole frontier of Australia begins to proliferate, adding to the Pacific regional connection. And much the same happens in the USA. Up in British Columbia in the 1850s, there's gold on the Fraser River. And then, of course, there's a movement into neighbouring Nevada, which some of you have heard a lot about today if you went to Virginia City. And if you did go to Virginia City, you will know that the Cornish Bay, an important part there too. And that strictly sense of sun that was evident in Grass Valley was also evident in Virginia City, where the Cornish, not only did they fall out with the Irish, but they tended to live in particular precincts within the wider Virginia City area, Gold Hill, which some of you would have known. But by then, by the second half of the 19th century, at the same time that the Pacific Rim is developing these myriad connections in the way that I've described, Cornwall itself is losing its place on the international mining map of the world. So it's no longer the centre of activity in the way that it was. By the end of the 19th century, in its place, South Africa has emerged as a principal destination for the emigrant Cornish. And the Pacific Rim perhaps loses its place in the focus in Cornwall itself. By the 20th century, Cornish emigration has more or less ground to a halt anyway. After the Second World War, there is still some movement overseas, but the great Cornish emigration, 1815 to 1914, is essentially at an end. But where it does go on, it still emphasizes the significance of the Pacific Rim. It's the point that I kind of want to end on, the enduring significance, despite those changes, of the Pacific Rim. Many of you will know the story of John Corrin, who in the late 1920s left his native Cornwall, where he worked himself for a mine, to go, like a number of other miners at the time, to Timmins in Ontario, Canadian government, giving subsidized passage for people to go to work in the Hollinger gold mine. And John Corrin got together, scraped together the money to go across to Ontario. But before long, he heard about Detroit down in Michigan and how you could make more money making motor cars. And he went to Detroit, but he found that that wasn't all that it was cracked up to be anyway, even the Great Depression and all of that. So he pitches his way across Los Angeles, right across the American continent. From there, he gets a tram steamer up to Oakland, here in San Francisco Bay Area. In Oakland, he finds another cousin Jack, another Cornish miner, who lends him the money to go up to Grass Valley. He arrives at Grass Valley one evening, he sleeps in the orchard at one of the stars. He's recognized by someone out of the farm. Elizabeth is a stranger. He says, "Are you a cousin Jack?" He says, "Yes, I am." He's invited in, he's given dinner. The next day, he's given a letter of introduction by the man whose house is sleeping in his apartment, who's also Cornish. He takes it to the head of the queue, where all these people from Bacchus are queuing up for $5 a day job in Grass Valley mines. And he gets to the head of the queue because he is, of course, a cousin Jack. He is a Cornish miner. The myth of cousin Jack has endured right up to the late 1920s, as has the position of the Grass Valley in the story of the Cornish emigration. Here, then, is still the Pacific Rim, Pacific region, exercising its attraction for Cornish miners, even at that late